Welcome to Two-Way Street. This week marks the 72nd anniversary of the death and subsequent funeral of President Franklin Roosevelt. He died on April 12, 1945, at the Little White House in Warm Springs, Georgia. The funeral took place on April 15th in Washington, D.C. In surveys of historians who are asked to rank the best presidents in American history, Roosevelt almost always pops up third, finishing behind only Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. His legacy is well known. Roosevelt took office in 1933 in the heart of the Depression. He quickly began passing laws to create government jobs to combat massive unemployment. And he helped states provide unemployment benefits for those who couldn't find work. Roosevelt worked to stabilize the banking industry and created a federal insurance program that to this day protects bank customers from losing their money if a bank fails. And of course, it was his administration that created Social Security. But today we're going to tell a story about Roosevelt that's not as well known as his sweeping achievements. During his administration, it was a woman, Marguerite Missy LeHand, who became his most trusted advisor. She essentially operated as his unofficial chief of staff, a position never before and never since held by a woman. We're going to talk about LeHand with author and journalist Catherine Smith. Her book is The Gatekeeper, Missy LeHand, FDR, and the Untold Story of the Partnership That Defined a Presidency. It's the first biography of the woman who became such a powerful force in Washington during FDR's tenure in the White House. Catherine Smith, thank you for being here for Two-Way Street.
Glad to be here.
We're going to get to Missy LeHand, but I think we should get to Missy LeHand if you're all right with this. I want to do it through your personal story.
Okay.
Because we learn late in your book, in your afterword, that you felt like you developed a very personal tie to FDR that eventually led you to Missy LeHand. How did that happen?
Well, it goes back to childhood, really. I had a grandfather. I'm from Macon, Georgia. My grandfather was a Yellow Dog Democrat. We all know what that is. And he just revered FDR because he had been a young husband and father during the early part of the Depression, and the family just struggled terribly. He always had a job. He was a newspaper printer, but the paychecks bounced a lot. So he was dependent on credit at grocery stores to feed the children and that kind of thing. So I really grew up with a great respect for FDR. And that really grew about 10 years ago, more longer than that. I had breast cancer. And I was just really, really frightened. I was 45 years old. I had two young children. And I didn't know if I was going to live or not to raise them. And one night, I just happened to be watching a PBS special on, I guess it was an American Experience, and it was on FDR. And the words of his first inaugural address, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," just resonated with me. And that just kind of became my mantra. Every time I got really scared, I would just think, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Because he talked about how paralyzing it was. And it really was. You know, you can't do anything when you're that afraid. So after I recovered, and thank goodness, I'm
glad to hear.
Glad to be here. I read even more about FDR. One of the books I really enjoyed was Jonathan Alter's book, The Defining Moment. And it was
Jonathan himself, a survivor of cancer.
That's right. And I felt, and he felt that connection with FDR also. And that was the book that had the most about Missy LeHand in it. And I just kept thinking how fascinating her life must have been. And a few years later, I thought, you know, I would love to read a biography about this woman. And I discovered no one had ever written one. I thought, how on earth is that possible? So I had, you know, I was just going to do a little self-published book and try to gather up what had already been written, little bits and pieces. And as soon as I got just right below the surface, I realized that almost everything that had been written about her was wrong. And it turned into a real full-fledged biography.
If you don't mind, I'd like to read a couple sentences back to you from your book.
Okay.
Here's what you say about Missy LeHand. There had never been anyone like Missy in the White House before, and it was a long time before anyone like Missy followed. The only other women besides First Ladies who have wielded as much influence over a president since Missy were Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor and Secretary of State for George W. Bush, and Barack Obama's senior advisor, Valerie Jarrett. So who was Missy LeHand?
She filled a lot of roles for Roosevelt. She came to work for him as a young woman when she was 23, as his private secretary. And over the years, she became his confidant, his close friend, his advisor, his sounding board, his defender, and his gatekeeper. She became the person who controlled a lot of access to FDR at the White House.
She was hired to work on his vice presidential campaign.
Right, and he was running with James M. Cox.
Yeah, exactly.
Who eventually owned the Atlanta newspapers and everything else in media here.
So Cox chose FDR to be his running mate.
Right.
And Missy somehow was brought in.
She was brought in to work at the campaign office, and she was hired by a man that she had met when she worked for a very brief time at the Department of the Navy in Washington. And after the loss to the Republicans, and it's just unbelievable that someone like James M. Cox, with his great abilities, could have lost to Warren G.
Harding. He was governor of Ohio at the time.
Warren G. Harding.
Yeah.
I always say that if Harding hadn't died in office, he probably would have made it to the top of the list of the worst presidents in U.S. history. But he didn't quite have 4 years. But anyway, the Democrats lost very much like this past election, and the party was in tatters. So Eleanor Roosevelt had invited Missy to come up to their home in Hyde Park to help clean up some of the leftover correspondence. And she and FDR got along so well, he said, I need a secretary. I'm going to go be working on Wall Street at a law firm and a bonding company, and I just need a really good, competent private secretary. Would you like to come work for me? And she said initially, I don't think so. I think that law work is really dull. And being a persuasive fellow, he said, oh, there'll be lots of other things besides law work. And he was right. And she came to work for him.
She came from a relatively poor background herself, and didn't have a great deal of education.
Well, you have to think about that, though. And that was one of the things I read a lot, about Missy. Despite having only a high school education, in that time, that was comparable to having a college education today. About 30% of adults had a high school education. And you have to remember, Eleanor Roosevelt didn't have a high school education. Her family made her drop out to, make her debut and find a husband. And we never say, despite not even having a high school education, Eleanor Roosevelt was able to blah, blah, blah. A lot of the people around FDR were from similarly working class backgrounds, not college educated, and certainly not Ivy League college as he was. So I think he kind of liked that. So
she was there in 1921 when what happened to FDR.
He went to Campobello Island on vacation and came down with infantile paralysis, poliomyelitis, and never walked again unassisted after that. So Missy became a very important player during that time. I called the chapters Adrift because he just was just lost. His mother wanted him to retire to the family home and run the farm, though, boy, if she was such a martinet, I don't think she would have given him very much to do.
Sarah Roosevelt really was uncomfortable that people should be, that her son's disability, his illness, should be exposed to the world.
Right.
She really wanted to sequester him.
Right. And a lot of people felt that way. There was a lot of questions about why you get polio. There was still a lot of, it must have been something you've done. It's a sin, so you get this disease. And people were kind of locked away in their homes. And so FDR said that if he was going to run for office, he had to be able to walk first. So he did a lot of rehabilitation. And finally, just kind of in disgust, in 1923, he leased a houseboat with a friend and went down to the Florida Keys to spend the winter fishing and swimming and sunning and drinking and just, having a good time. And Eleanor went with him, but she didn't stay. Missy went with them, and she became the hostess on the houseboat.
Yeah, they. I assume that it was the polio more than anything in the early days of their knowing each other that really created the bond between them, partly because he needed her, but also because she had her own illness.
She did.
That
she,
helped her relate to him.
Yeah. One thing that I discovered when I was researching the book was that she didn't graduate from high school until she was 20, which was really late then. And it was because she'd had rheumatic fever and had probably spent a couple of years in bed. That was what happened with children. It permanently damaged her heart and led to her very early death at age 47. But she knew what it was like to be, you know, laid out flat. And I think that was one of the understandings. A lot of the people around FDR had very serious health problems. His political guru, Louis Howe, had serious heart and lung problems, even though he smoked like a chimney. Harry Hopkins, who became one of his top aides, had very serious problems related to stomach cancer. And I think that that bond of disability was important to all of them.
When he first discovered Warm Springs, was Missy with him?
Yes. Yes. Missy and Eleanor and his valet, a young man named Roy Jones, came down to Warm Springs on the train in 1924. He'd heard about it from an old college friend who was the part owner of the resort. And what this friend told him was a young man who had a cottage, family had a cottage there, he was a Georgian, had come and had exercised in the warm mineral waters, and eventually had been able to walk with just a cane. And that was what Franklin Roosevelt was aiming for. Crutches are a medical device, but a cane can be a fashion accessory. So that's what he hoped to do. So they got down to Warm Springs, and Eleanor did not care for the place at all. The institutional racism really bugged her, and just the poverty. I mean, we think of the Roaring Twenties as this time of great prosperity, but in the agricultural communities, not at all.
This is rural Georgia, pre-Tennessee Valley Authority, no electrification in much of the rural South.
Right.
This is what Franklin Roosevelt came to love and want to change.
Yeah.
But Eleanor wanted to go back to New York.
Yeah. I think that the final straw was she and Missy went over to Manchester one day to buy some chicken for supper, and she found out she had to buy it on the hoof. and then the cook killed the chicken in the yard. And I just, I make this up, but I just imagined Eleanor saying, "Oh, Missy, what would I do if Franklin wanted steak for supper?" But she went home after that. And they had, you know, she had five children. She had a lot of things that she was involved with. And again, she left her husband in Missy's care as, you know, his assistant and the hostess and the unlicensed nurse at Warm Springs.
You know, it's well documented, obviously, that Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt had an unusual marriage, an unusual partnership.
Yeah.
They went their separate ways on many occasions. And the question that I think we might as well address right now, since Missy was down there in a Warm Springs when Eleanor was back, was you tell us that there may have been some romantic relationship between the two of them, right?
Could be. But we really just, there's no way to know. What I do in the book is lay out the reasons that could have happened and then the reasons that it couldn't have happened. There's some question about his ability after the polio. But there are a lot of questions in my mind because Missy was a Roman Catholic. She was a single woman. Birth control was very unreliable then. She had a heart condition in which she had been told that pregnancy would kill her. So a lot of reasons not to. And plus she had a tremendous admiration for Eleanor Roosevelt.
Well, and interestingly enough, you tell us that Eleanor was certainly capable of jealousy. She became very jealous of Lucy Mercer, who is a woman
very
closely associated with him romantically.
Yeah.
But for some reason, she thought Missy Harbor was a safe harbor.
Apparently so. It's been said that maybe it's because Lucy Mercer came from the same social class. She was a very, very beautiful woman. And Missy was attractive, but not in that way, and was just, you know, working class Irish American. So there are some things that I think just can never be answered. Eleanor certainly documented her life thoroughly, but FDR never left a diary, and neither did Missy. So,
but the relationship between Missy and FDR, whether it was consummated
sexually or not, became
so close. You have a wonderful little detail in your book. I think it was after the presidential race. She was fun. Right? They had fun together.
Yes, yes.
What did he give her? What was the little bracelet that he gave
her? Well, she had a charm bracelet. And all through the book, I talk about the charms on the bracelet. And I don't know who the different charms came on it, but one of my favorites is a little teeny pocket knife that says, "Let's cut up."
And that came from him?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't?
I don't know that.
Well,
but it had a miniature martini shaker on it. It just had all kinds of things. So Eleanor hated alcohol because her father had been a hopeless alcoholic. Her brother Hall died of alcoholism. And she was very disapproving. You know, Prohibition was going on, but that really didn't matter to folks like the Roosevelts. They could always get booze. But Missy was an Irish Catholic, and she didn't have any problem with drinking.
You know, it's ironic that Eleanor hated alcohol because, of course, one of the evening rituals, if you were a part of the inner circle of FDR, you gathered for cocktails every evening.
Yeah.
And Missy LeHand would have been part of it.
She was
gatherings.
The hostess. FDR called it the children's hour at the White House. And the only child who was actually there was Harry Hopkins' daughter, Diana, who was one of the many people who lived in the White House from time to time. And she was one of the only two people I was able to interview had ever met Missy were Diana and another lady who was a child at the time. And Mrs. Hopkins, is Mrs. Halstead now, told me that she used to sit on FDR's lap sometime during children's hour while he was shaking the martinis, and he kept his desk covered with all kinds of little mechanical toys and animals and little donkeys, and she'd play with all that stuff while the adults were talking.
So we're still in this rehabilitation phase.
Sure.
As we tell the story now. Yeah. Roosevelt is still hoping he'll be able to walk, at least with a cane.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, of course, anyone who visits Warm Springs, the Little White House, will see that extraordinary collection of canes sent to Roosevelt from all over the world because he was so beloved.
Yeah, yeah. And everyone should, I mean, especially every Georgian should visit the Little White House. It is just such a treat to go to Warm Springs. I did a lot of my research there. The people there are so lovely. And when you go into that little, I mean, that little White House and the tiny little room, the little single bed where he died, I mean, every time I see it, it just makes me well up with tears. But it's a really wonderful experience. The museum there is very good. You can go down and see the pools are no longer filled with water, but you can go in, down and walk into them and feel what the hot water felt like. And you just got a really good feel for the place. And plus, you've got the Bullock House, which is a great place to go eat lunch, or you could stay at the Hotel Warm Springs where Betty Davis stayed.
Chamber of Commerce, Catherine.
I know. I loved it there.
So we're in the rehabilitation phase. He's hoping to walk again. And then in 1928, the Democratic Party of New York prevails upon him to run for governor.
Yeah.
Did Missy like that idea?
No.
Why?
She felt that he was close to reaching that goal of being able to walk. He'd worked out kind of what they called a political, what we would think of as a political walk. He would snap his braces stiff, and he would hold a cane in one hand, the fashion accessory, and in the other he would put it through the arm of one of his tall, strong sons or another strong man and kind of swing his shoulders and swing his legs forward. And if everything worked right, he could appear to be walking. But it took tremendous effort, and he would just be covered with sweat, and whoever he was holding on to would go away with bruises on their arms from the grasp of his hands. So, but short distances, he could do this walk. Missy thought, I believe, that he could have continued his rehab and gotten better at that. So when the Democratic Party came calling, she kept saying, "Don't you dare, don't you dare, don't you dare." But he dared, and he won.
So he suddenly had not only Sarah Roosevelt, his mother, very upset that he'd gone back to public life, but Missy was not happy with him either.
Well, once he won, you know, I think with Missy is once you're in it, you're going to win it. And so this was the beginning of a whole different life for her. She became his private secretary at Albany. Eleanor Roosevelt invited her to come and live in the governor's mansion, which worked for Eleanor's interest as well as FDR's.
Tell me now, because we're going to approach 1932 when he's nominated and eventually wins the White House. Help us understand the kind of roles Missy was taking on as he rose in prominence politically.
Yeah. She worked out of the governor's mansion. He had an office at the Capitol, but he did, I think, probably most of his business at home. He had a study. He'd have his press conferences there. He'd have people over to dinner and that kind of thing. And Missy just filled a number of roles. I describe her as the Swiss Army knife of the White House staff, but she was also like that in Albany because Eleanor Roosevelt was, despite not having a high school education, was the part owner and principal or assistant principal and teacher at a school in Manhattan, a girls' school. And she loved teaching. And just because she was First Lady of New York, she wasn't going to give it up. So she taught in New York 3 days a week and left Missy in charge as the hostess at the governor's mansion. So that meant she was directing the staff, ordering the groceries, handling all of FDR's private correspondence, and just, you know, overseeing the building of a swimming pool, just all kinds of things.
But you point out that in 1932, when the decision is made, he will definitely run for the Democratic nomination for president, that she becomes part of the brain trust, the inner circle working to help him win that nomination.
Right. She wasn't part of the brain trust. That was the mostly college professors stuff. But yeah, but definitely part of the inner circle, the speech writing team on the campaigns. And she rode on all the campaign trains. And that was one of my favorite parts of the book, just describing how exciting that was and going just because it was there was just this huge groundswell. Hoover had just kind of lost his way as president. He'd run out of ideas. And Franklin Roosevelt had such enthusiasm. He had that beautiful big smile. He gave people hope. So it had to have been just incredibly exciting campaigning on that train.
At that point, we're 3 years into the Depression.
Right.
And you tell a wonderful story about a first in political history, really. Democratic convention in 1932 was in Chicago.
Yeah.
And Roosevelt's waiting in New York to be nominated because he's got an airplane standing by.
Yeah.
And he's going to fly to Chicago and become the first presidential nominee to accept the nomination in person. And you describe that plane trip in vivid detail. It's lots of fun.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite parts of the book is that it was just this little tiny airplane. It was like the length of a living room. It was made of corrugated metal, and they had wicker and aluminum seats. And it was Missy was on that plane. She'd never flown before. And, you know, the idea that this nominee is going to get on an airplane and fly to Chicago, it's like, oh, yeah, Franklin Roosevelt's going to take a rocket ship to the moon because it was just so unusual. And he felt like he had to do that to make a big splash. So they had, you know, it was a terrible flight. There was a storm. Everybody on the plane except maybe FDR got sick. But they landed and 25,000 people came out to meet the plane. And just a really had to be so thrilling. But Missy was trying to type the last draft of the acceptance speech while they're flying. And finally, her typewriter almost flew off the table into her lap and she turned green and passed it off to her assistant.
Well, we've all been on those flights. Oh, very happy when the wheels touch the tarmac. He wins the White House.
Yeah.
And as a symbol of just how important she is, the Oval Office and the surrounding offices, it's a small space.
Yeah.
A lot of competition for the offices to be close to the President of the United States.
Yeah.
I'll bet you the Trump people have been going through it right now, these days.
Yeah.
Where does Missy LaHand
She's end got
up?
The only office adjoining his. Yeah. And the West Wing was reconfigured a couple of years later, and again, she got the only office adjoining his. So she outmaneuvered Louis Howe, who wanted to stick her away in the White House. There was a lot of jealousy, especially with Louis, who had been FDR's advisor for so long. And he gave Missy a picture, a signed picture that said something about to Missy Lehan, who has been with us low how many years, we won't say how many, fighting for me, with me, and against me. So there was a lot of, you know, knocking of heads, I think.
But there was another key component to that office. Mm-hmm. I think it had an entrance to the outdoors.
Yes, yes.
Why was that important?
Because she could slip people in the back door who didn't want to be on the official calendar or who she wanted to get into FDR. But he would, a lot of times, he would tell people, if you have trouble with my getting through to my appointment secretary, just come see Miss Lehan. She'll bring you in the back door. And she got some very useful people in to see him that way. So,
what was the relationship between Lucy Mercer and Missy Lehan? Was there jealousy there?
I read in one book I read said that Lucy cultivated her friendship, but her family says that she was not at all happy about it. So I don't know. That I really couldn't get a beat on that. But if FDR wanted to talk to Lucy, Missy was going to make sure he got to talk to Lucy.
Yeah.
So, but the really close reignition of FDR and Lucy's relationship happened after Missy had had a stroke and was pretty much out of the picture.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a few minutes because it's a very sad ending to the story.
Yeah.
In the White House, it becomes clear to the outside world that Missy Lehan is a power broker. Time magazine puts her on the cover in 1934.
Yeah, they had, it's kind of been interesting watching, of course, the new appointments with this new presidential administration. Everybody's got these various titles, communications director and senior this and senior that. The White House of Roosevelt was run by four secretaries who were known as a group as the White House Secretariat. It was Louis Howe, who I've mentioned, Steve Early, who was FDR's press secretary, Marvin McIntyre, who handled appointments, and Missy, who did everything else. And in 1934, the four of them appeared together on the cover of Time. And it was only the third cover of the entire year, 52 issues, that had a woman on it. Hard to believe.
So at that point, I want to make sure I have this right. More than anything else, Missy Lehan was not helping craft policy day to day per se, right?
Well, I don't know. I think that she probably had a lot to do with it as a sounding board. The real mystery, and if I could be a fly on the wall in the 30s, I would love to have been a fly on the wall in FDR's study at night when many times Missy was just up there working with him on his stamp collections. And that was the time of day that FDR would think about, process everything he'd heard during the day. And I think there was a lot of conversation between them. People said that she was one of the very few people who would tell him no, that this was a mistake. But I think she did have a big influence on appointments and on personnel. One of the people she slipped in the back door was Tommy Corcoran, who was a attorney with the government, and they'd gotten to be friends. He was an Irish Catholic also, and she brought him in to play the accordion for FDR for after supper one night. And Tommy was he lived with another classmate, from Harvard, Ben Cohen. Ben Cohen and Tommy Corcoran drafted some of the most important New Deal legislation, and Tommy was the one who was the lobbyist for the White House. He was the first White House lobbyist and got things through. So he was tremendously important and influential, and Missy was the one who got him into FDR's orbit.
Let's take a break right now. When we return, more with Catherine Smith and the story of the partnership between FDR and Missy Lehan. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest on today's show is Catherine Smith. She's the author of The Gatekeeper, Missy LeHand, FDR, and the Untold Story of the Partnership That Defined a Presidency. Missy LeHand was with him through some of the most trying early years of the lead up to World War II, of course,
right.
When there was enormous pressure on Roosevelt trying to understand what the role of the United States would be, fighting the isolationists who didn't want anything to do with the war. Given the closeness of their relationship, having her there through that sort of crises must have been terribly important to him, you would guess. Yeah.
Right, right. After Missy was out of commission, by that time Pearl Harbor happened, and Sam Rosamond, who was another real close advisor, his chief speechwriter, came in a few days after Pearl Harbor and in the evening, and he noticed that FDR was just by himself working on his stamp collection. And he said, and it occurred to me that if Missy had been there, she would be sitting up with him. And he was just there by himself. So Sam stayed up with him until, 11 o'clock, and he went to bed. So I think, that she was his companion on so many things. And just think what the pressure was like on her to always be available. You know, she lived on the third floor of the White House. She really could never get away from it.
Yeah, I mean, you point out that she did have a couple of boyfriends throughout her lifetime.
Yeah,
but she was maybe in some ways as lonely as he became.
Right. And I think the one that she had the longest relationship was a man named William Christian Bullitt. And she was involved with him from 1933 to 1940. But I think one of the things she really liked about him is that he was an ambassador. So as long as he stayed on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean and she could write him mushy letters and he could come to town and take her out and, spoiler a bit, she really liked her job. She really liked her career, and she really loved working for the Roosevelts.
We've talked about the fact she had a childhood illness. She had rheumatic fever.
Mm-hmm.
She was ill off and on. She had bouts with illness throughout her life. But by 1941, the rheumatic fever. She smoked a lot of cigarettes, I think.
I can't imagine what the White House must have smelled like, because they all smoked like chimneys. Yeah, she was a 2 or 3 pack-a-day smoker. And the stress that spring of 1941 between the isolationists and the interventionists was tremendous. FDR had illness all that spring himself, so Missy and Harry Hopkins had pretty much just been chained to his bedside. And she'd had a lot of trouble sleeping. She started taking opiates to sleep. She was just in really bad shape herself.
And which led to what eventually? A stroke?
She had a heart attack, and followed by a lot of other related cardiovascular illness. She went to a hospital, and there she had a major stroke. And it left her paralyzed on one side and really unable to speak. And we've all known people who've had devastating strokes like that and how awful it is.
Yeah. Roosevelt sent her down to Warm Springs to recuperate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he knew that they had an excellent brace shop at Warm Springs and just great physical therapists. So he thought that would be a place where she could, maybe start walking again. And but in the end, she was so depressed. She was so isolated, down there in a little southern town, far away from everything that she loved.
And what contributed to that was Roosevelt, like many women and men in positions of that kind of power, could open and seal off his emotional chambers.
Yeah.
And he had, for a variety of reasons, he had to put Missy to the side, yes.
Yeah. He had been very, very involved in her health care, brought in the list of specialists who came in to see her was just the A-team from anywhere in the country. But when he was finally told by her sort of supervising physician there just wasn't much that could be done for her, I think he realized that he was just going to have to look after her, but that part of their relationship was over. And she came back to the White House for a few months in 1942, and from the nurse's records, it appeared she was just staying in a room drinking a lot. And she was a smoker. She set her bed on fire, you know, so they had to get her out of there. It would burn down the White House. And FDR was terribly afraid of fire, as you can imagine, being a paralyzed person. So she went home to her family in Massachusetts. And one of the really hard things to accept is that after that, FDR never saw her again. And he wrote her, he called her. Whenever anyone from the White House was coming, he'd send a little gift and a note. He sent some very lovely gifts. And he paid all of her medical expenses. And he put her in his will on an equal footing with Eleanor, because he wanted to be sure that if he died first, she would be cared for.
He never saw her again.
No.
But you tell us she saw him. She went to the movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And watched a newsreel.
Yeah.
Tell us about that experience.
It was in, he had just accepted the nomination for his fourth term in 1944, July 1944. And anyone who's seen pictures of Franklin Roosevelt over the last 2 years of his life is just shocked by how thin he'd gotten, how haggard. He was dying by then. And Missy went to the movies and was so upset by his on the newsreel that she asked to go home. And she went up to her room and she was looking through her box of souvenirs, pictures, and things like that from her White House years. And her sister heard a strange noise in her room, and she'd had another stroke and she died the next morning.
So, what does the inscription on her grave say?
She was utterly selfless in her devotion to duty, which was, I think, is a very fitting epitaph. It's part of the statement that was released by the White House after her death. Now, whether it was really the words of FDR or his press secretary, but it's, you know, attributed to FDR on her gravestone. He was on the other side of the country doing military inspections, so he didn't come to her funeral, but Eleanor came, and a lot of the luminaries from that time, Felix Frankfurter, the Supreme Court Justice, Joseph P. Kennedy, who'd been the ambassador to Britain, was in Missy's friend, and 1,200 people came to the funeral. Huge.
So as a professional woman in 2017,
mm-hmm.
and after all the work you've done to learn about Missy Lehand, what are your reflections about who she was at her time in history, how important she is to the arc of women in contemporary history? How do you reflect on all that?
One of the things that came out during the presidential campaign was about Hillary Clinton talking about being one of the early people in women in law, the law school, and how, you know, they would just have catcalls from the male students and she'd just keep her head down and keep working. I think that was something that Missy learned to do. She was she tried to stay in the background. She was profiled in magazines and things like that, but she would say, oh, no, I never talk about politics. I'm just a secretary. So by this self-deprecating speech and behavior was how she kept on becoming, you know, doing the things she did and keeping her influence. But I think that's one reason that there was such a long gap before you had another woman with that much import in the White House. I mean, that all the way to Condoleezza Rice, all the way, you know. So I admire her tremendously for just getting the job done and for being so smart and clever and non-threatening. But the sad thing is that she's been forgotten, too, though I hope my book has brought her back into the limelight to some degree.
Well, it has. Your book is The Gatekeeper, Missy Lehand, FDR, and the Untold Story of the Partnership That Defined a Presidency. Catherine Smith, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you. We always love talking FDR stories on
yes.
Two-Way Street because of his incredible relationship to the state of Georgia. And you've added to that conversation today. So thank you so much for being here.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
We have more information about Catherine Smith's book at our website, gpb.org/TWS, and on our Facebook page. We've also posted a link to the State Department of Natural Resources website about the Little White House. You can find information on how to get there, the hours that it's open for visits, and what you'll see when you go. We're going to take another break right now. When we come back, more about FDR and Georgia. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. As we mentioned at the start of today's show, this week marks the 72nd anniversary of the death and subsequent funeral of Franklin Roosevelt. The funeral was held on April 15th in Washington. Hundreds of thousands of people flocked there to say goodbye to the president who had led them through the Depression and through the darkest years of World War II.
On a six-horse field artillery caisson, escorted by representatives of every branch of the nation's armed forces, the casket passes grief-stricken throngs of people en route from the station to the White House. Warplanes pay a final tribute to the fallen commander-in-chief, and officers and men of the mighty armed forces which he led march in slow, measured tread in Franklin Roosevelt's honor.
That final journey began in the Georgia town that Roosevelt loved dearly, Warm Springs, and it was there, at the Little White House, that he died on April 12, 1945.
A little bit after lunch, he leans over and says, "I have a headache," and never recovers, and he dies within 3 hours.
Kay Lenning Minshew told us the story of Roosevelt's death when she visited us to talk about her book on FDR in Georgia last fall. On that last visit, Roosevelt had come to Warm Springs to escape, even briefly, the burdens that the war had placed on his shoulders. It was at the Little White House that he'd always found peace during visits that had stretched out for almost a quarter of a century. Eleanor rarely came with him, and so on the day that he had the cerebral hemorrhage that killed him, four people were with him: his longtime companion, Lucy Rutherford, two cousins, and a painter, Madame Shumatov. She was painting his portrait, and that work hangs unfinished to this day in the Little White House. On the day he died, Roosevelt had been scheduled to attend a lunch with Warm Springs residents. And given his reputation for punctuality, folks were surprised when he didn't show up on time.
The community was going to have a big picnic that day in Warm Springs.
And everybody's waiting for him.
Mm-hmm. And they pull up and, you know, say the president is gone. And people everywhere felt like their best friend had died. I quote a farmer who was out in the field, a black man, and somebody comes by and, you know, "Did you hear the news?" And he had to quit plowing because he felt like his best friend had died.
From his beloved second home at Warm Springs, Georgia, the body of Franklin Delano Roosevelt moves on the first stages of its journey to his final resting place. Scores of sufferers from infantile paralysis sorrowfully bid farewell to their great friend and benefactor. The president's dog follows his beloved master. Aboard a special train beginning the 24-hour trip back to Washington, the 31st President of the United States leaves Warm Springs forever.
The funeral cortege goes through the whole community, and you describe it to us, but without question, one of the most moving passages in this entire book is a quote from Graham Jackson. Who was Graham Jackson?
Graham Jackson was a wonderful accordion player and musician. People in Atlanta will know him because he played for years at Mary Mack's Tea Room.
He was African American.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was playing his accordion as the cortege came by.
He was going to be playing it the night before for the community picnic because he was one of FDR's favorite. And instead, he had to console patients and the community members.
What he later said about the moment that the cortege came through is poetry.
Mm-hmm. I saw everything and I heard every sound, and what I heard seemed to mean even more than what I saw. I heard the sighing of the pines and the singing of the mockingbird. Regiments of soldiers had come in during the night, and I heard the scraping of their leather boots and the noise of thousands of shifting rifles, the sound of wheels on the gravel and the click of camera shutters. The hearse came around the small flower bed in front of Georgia Hall and stopped there a minute, just like he used to pause and wave at the patients as he drove along. It was like his last goodbye. Then the car with Mrs. Roosevelt. I saw her through the glass. It seemed as if she was thinking of everybody else and supporting the whole crowd herself, being so brave. I glanced to my left at the long line of those poor, pitiful people. They were keyed up and so tense, and so I lifted my accordion and sounded the opening chords of the Largo of the New World Symphony, and I played Going Home. Surprise, relief, and then a look of peace and being comforted seemed to come to every face.
The people of Warm Springs had come to love FDR, and he returned their affection. But the rest of the country benefited from Roosevelt's visits to Georgia, too. Riding around the countryside here, he saw the poverty of farm families, saw that they were living without electricity. And much of what he saw helped inspire programs that established him as one of our most compassionate presidents. So on this day, we remember him as we mark the 72nd anniversary of the death and funeral of FDR. Just about out of time for today's show, but before we leave you, I want to remind you that even if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can listen to Two Way Street. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from, or you can go to our website. All of our shows are archived there. Our senior producer is the heartwarmingly hip Jenny Ament. Jenny also edited today's show. Our producer is the habitually hilarious Lisa Clark, and our engineer is the harmonically high-flying Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for being with us today. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
No more fret, no pain, no more stumbling on.